for argument this morning is Sporl against Kraft Foods Global. Mr. Connolly.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Section 203 of the Fair Labor Standards Act mandates that any time spent in changing clothes shall be excluded from working time if so provided in the express terms of or by customer practice under a bona fide collective bargaining agreement. Here it is undisputed that Kraft and the plaintiff's union have had a series of bona fide collective bargaining agreements dating back to the 1950s, and since the mid-1980s, it excluded time spent changing into and out of boots, frocks, hard hats, hairnets, shirts, jackets, and pants. That's clear. The plaintiffs nevertheless...
You're taking the radical position that pants are clothing.
I am, Your Honor. Plaintiffs nevertheless...
Let me tell you my problem with your argument. As a matter of federal law, this statute says that it's excluded if this is clothing. But the difficulty here is that the district court's decision rests on state law, and your brief consistently disregards what seems to me the critical language in Section 203O. It begins by saying, in determining for the purposes of Sections 206 and 207 of this title, something. But your position depends on reading it as saying, for all purposes, something is excluded. But if it's limited, as it says, to Sections 206 and 207 of this title, how can it affect state law?
I think the simple answer is that statement in a preamble in the Fair Labor Standards Act is simply that. It's a preamble explaining its application under that act. But we find the same thing in Labor Management Relations Act.
Under the Act, just for purposes of 206 and 207 of the Act.
Well,
then we get to Section 218A, and 218A says, roughly, if the state law provides a higher minimum wage, it wins.
Exactly. To answer the first part, it doesn't say just for purposes of Section 206 or 207. It says in determining for purposes of 206 and 207. And I grant you that if this court were so inclined and you were willing to ignore the body of case law, federal case law, saying that collective bargaining agreements should be given sanctity, and you ignore the purposes of 203O itself, which is clearly stated.
If I understand Wisconsin law, Wisconsin law says we don't give a fig what's in the collective bargaining agreement. We're not going to try to interpret the collective bargaining agreement. We're going to ignore it. Suppose the collective bargaining agreement between Kraft and the union had said, notwithstanding state law, the wage will be the federal minimum wage, even if state law provides a higher minimum wage. Right. Would you say that that trumps, because it's in a collective bargaining agreement, that that trumps the state minimum wage?
218A addresses
exactly
minimum wage, work week,
so
maximum work week, or child labor.
Yeah.
So if it fits into those, then no, it's not preempted.
Exactly. So you're not taking the position that as long as we put in a collective bargaining agreement something that says we workers are willing to accept less than the state minimum wage, that prevails.
Agreed.
But isn't that exactly where we come down to here? You're saying we put in this collective bargaining agreement that we're going to accept less than the state minimum wage by removing from the wage base some hours, and therefore, as a matter of federal law, that wins. That beats the state law.
I don't see the exceptions applying here. Certainly you'd agree that the exception for child labor doesn't apply. And I think you'd have to agree that the exception for minimum wage doesn't apply. So the only argument is that the exception for maximum work week applies. But if you read it so broadly as to say that even a very narrowly tailored exception under 203O, saying that the parties shall exclude collectively bargained changes in clothing at the beginning and end of the day is subsumed within this broad exception for maximum work week, then there is nothing that's not excluded on that basis. In other words, 218A is a narrow set of specific exemptions which tie in closely to what's said.
Let me change my hypothetical. Instead of saying the workers agree that we will accept the federal minimum wage even if the state minimum wage is higher, it says the workers agree that for the purpose of computing the state minimum wage, we will agree to be paid for 90% of the hours we actually worked. Do you think that that would trump the state minimum wage? That is, we're going to pay the state minimum wage per hour worked, but we'll agree to multiply that by 0.9 and not get paid for all the hours we actually worked. Well, would that preempt state law?
There are cases, Your Honor, where unions and a company agreed that for those workers who are going to work more than 8 hours a day, say 12-hour days, that they would use a different standard wage, and that courts have upheld that as not violating the Fair Labor Standards Act. Despite the fact that they varied wages.
Counsel, yeah. I'm not asking what violates the Fair Labor Standards Act. I'm asking whether, if you put in a collective bargaining agreement, the provision, we will agree to be paid, for purposes of state law, for only 90% of the hours actually worked, whether that would prevent the state minimum wage from providing a higher pay than the federal minimum wage.
I think the answer is yes, that would not be permissible if the state minimum wage were higher, because effectively it would undermine it. But I don't think from that hypothetical.
Exactly what this does, there's a collective bargaining agreement, and it says we the workers agree with management that certain hours won't count, even though state law provides that they do count.
I think the answer is in 2030, Your Honor. In 2030, you have an express statement as to what the parties can collectively bargain over.
For the purposes of sections 206 and 207.
It says in determining, it doesn't say for the purposes, in determining for the purposes of 206 and 207. But, Your Honor, if that's what the court is going to hang its hat to say that 2030 wasn't intended to provide certainty for the parties, then you'd be stuck with the same problem under the Labor Management Relations Act, which has any number of preambles and yet preempts an area. There are analogous statutes. Section 158, which deals with the obligation to bargain collectively, says, for the purpose of this section, to bargain collectively will be this. But we still apply it as preempting state laws to the contrary on what is proper bargaining. In Section 163 of the Labor Management Relations Act, you have a right to strike that's preserved, and the statement, though, is nothing in this subchapter shall be construed so as to either interfere with or impede or diminish in any way the right to strike, and yet we apply that same law. What is applied, the same preambles are in various parts of federal law, which is still preempted. And the question then is, where there is this preamble, can you look to congressional intent to determine whether or not it was merely stated as an exception for the particular labor act, or is it a general preemption? And it seems to me that here the history of 2030 makes clear its purpose. The history of 2030 was to protect the ability of parties to collectively bargain. And if you were to say that the state of Wisconsin, contrary to the express exceptions under 218A, could simply adopt a contrary provision and create a hodgepodge of state laws with respect to this very narrow issue that's addressed in 2030, then you've essentially rendered 2030, you've lost the sanctity of the bargaining agreement that this court and federal courts have generally upheld. You've lost what Congressman Herter made clear was the intent of 2030, which is to permit the parties to collectively bargain in this narrow area of changing clothes, times for changing clothes at the beginning and end of the day. And ultimately, you've lost not only the exception that what we're saying is a direct conflict of 2030, but you're also losing 301 preemption. So, and 301 preemption applies here whether or not the court views this as 203 preamble as having the impact that has been suggested by Judge Easterbrook. 2030 says that if you have to look to the definition under 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act, if you have to look to the collective bargaining to understand, or if it encompasses not only state law claims that directly are based on collective bargaining agreement, but also all those that substantially depend upon analysis of the terms of the agreement. By definition, 2030 depends on the collective bargaining agreement. Indeed, 2030 says where the parties have collectively bargained, then that will control. Preemption under Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act says that where you have to look to a collective bargaining agreement to understand the agreement of the parties or the terms of the agreement between the parties, then it preempts contrary state law. So whether or not you view 2030 as standing alone, which I think a reasonable reading of 2030 and certainly of the intent of Congress in passing it, as we've quoted repeatedly, was to create a sanctity of the labor agreement with respect to these specific areas. You know, originally, Congressman Herter proposed a general preemption for all agreements under collective bargaining, which was consistent with the general view that where the parties are represented by union and by management, they're not in need of these minimum standards under the Labor Relations Act. But that was not agreed to by Congress. What was agreed was in two narrow settings, washing at the beginning and end of the day and putting on clothing at the beginning and the end of the day, that we would respect the collective bargaining agreement of the parties. And that is a narrow exception. It's consistent with the general exceptions under the collective bargaining agreement and with the general supremacy clause applied to the collective bargaining agreement. And in addition, it depends on an interpretation. By definition, 2030 depends on an interpretation of collective bargaining agreement, which requires 301 preemption, even if you don't find it directly under the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Does this stuff come under clothing, as far as you're concerned?
I think that the great weight of the cases that we cite, and particularly Judge Cicerone's decision out of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, there's no fair reading of these as not being clothing, Your Honor. I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Conley.
May it please the Court. I'd like to start out just by adding a little to the discussion you just had. As is clear from our briefs, plaintiffs contend that the Wisconsin laws fall squarely under create a lower maximum work week and therefore fall squarely under Section 218A. In addition, the Wisconsin regulation, which provides that Kraft must compensate plaintiffs for the donning and doffing time in this case, is part of the minimum wage regulations under Wisconsin law. Wisconsin Administrative Code DWD 272.12 provides the interpretation of hours worked that is used by the Wisconsin wage payment and Wisconsin overtime laws, but it is part of the Wisconsin minimum wage laws, and we believe for that reason it also falls squarely under the minimum wage anti-preemption provision that is found in Section 218A. Plaintiffs contend that the Section 301 preemption issue is not properly before this court because it was waived by Kraft before the district court, and the district court did not rule on that issue. In any event, responding to the argument that Mr. Conley made regarding whether 2030 depends on analysis of the collective bargaining agreement, that's only an argument that Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act might preempt the Fair Labor Standards Act. That says nothing about any preemption that might be required under state law. The state laws at issue here do not require any analysis, any interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement. The administrative regulation provides the interpretation of hours worked, all that is necessary to determine whether plaintiffs must be compensated for the donning and doffing in time in this case is to apply the Wisconsin law.
What about the rate of pay? I assume that
the rate of pay, you might need a reference to determine the rate of pay to require damages. Courts have been clear, including the Supreme Court, that is not sufficient to require preemption under Section 301. And the Supreme Court has also been clear that, and I quote Metropolitan Life Insurance Company, that it would turn the policy that animated the Wagner Act on its head to understand it to have penalized workers who have chosen to join a union by preventing them from benefiting from state labor regulations imposing minimal standards on non-union employers.
With the addition of the dressing time, or whatever we call it, it's about, was it 6 minutes that we've determined that's...
It ranges between 5 minutes and 12 minutes per day, depending on the...
So it's going to vary with each employee, then.
It does vary with each employee. The parties have reached a settlement agreement. There is no dispute as to the damage that would be awarded to each individual plaintiff in this case.
We're looking forward. In effect, we've got, I assume, do they work 8 hours a day?
I believe so.
So you got an 8-hour and 6-minute day, right?
That may be the case.
I wonder if that comes into overtime.
Correct.
So there's cleanup time. If you work an 8-hour day, 5 days a week, 40 hours, I'm assuming this, that may not be correct, then that extra 6 minutes, that'd have to be overtime, wouldn't it?
It may put them into overtime, but it doesn't change the fact that it's hours that the plaintiffs are working.
I'm just trying to clear this up. What you're really doing is it's part of the workday.
Correct. Wisconsin law is clear that it's part of the workday. Essentially, Wisconsin law has adopted the preliminary analysis that the Fair Labor Standards Act uses, but it does not have the exception under 2030. So regardless of whether the equipment that's donned and doffed in this case are considered clothes, Wisconsin law provides that that craft must pay plaintiffs for the time they spend donning and doffing.
I'm having a hard time understanding why this isn't the appropriate case for collective bargaining. I mean, they gave up the right to be compensated for this in exchange for a pay raise, and that seems to be a lot cleaner way to handle this than something like federal judges deciding if the 6 minutes at the start and end of the day, if this is clothing or not, what their compensation for. It just seems like a cleaner way to decide an issue like this. It's not child labor laws or minimum wage concerns.
Plaintiffs would respectfully disagree and contend that it is minimum wage and maximum hour concerns, which are squarely excluded from preemption. Also, bargaining parties simply do not have the ability to bargain away rights.
You can't bargain away these ceiling and floor issues, but I mean, suppose that the company were to say, "You have to you have this equipment, but you keep it at your house, and you have to come to work dressed to go to work."
That would be a different situation because plaintiffs, because they are required to keep the equipment at work, cannot get dressed in the morning. They have to get dressed in the morning to go to work, and then they have to don and doff the equipment once they're there.
I prefer to get dressed at work than to wear my beard net. Judge Easterbrook wouldn't need a beard net. I don't. But to get to work in the morning.
But by requiring plaintiffs to get dressed at work, it's adding additional work time to their work day. They can't substitute the time they would otherwise have to spend getting dressed in the morning for putting on. They can't put on their equipment first thing in the morning and not have to change into the equipment later. As the district court held, Wisconsin law sets a lower maximum hours than the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act by including in hours worked time that may be excluded under a collective bargaining agreement for purposes of application of the Fair Labor Standards Act. That plaintiff's contention puts it squarely within the realm of laws, maximum hour and minimum wage laws, that were reserved to the states and which are something that parties simply cannot bargain over.
Well, of course, they can bargain over the wage. And if you prevail in this case, I assume what happens in the next bargaining is that the employer will offer a lower wage per hour. If the workers are going to say state law is going to put in the wage base more hours than federal law does, the employer responds, we pay a lower wage per hour. So why isn't your argument necessarily interfering with collective bargaining about the wage per hour?
The argument doesn't interfere with collective bargaining about the wage per hour because the fact that, depending on the outcome of this case, Kraft may try to decrease the wage doesn't mean that they'll be successful. It means that that will be maybe on the table at the next bargaining negotiations.
Well, of course, in this case, though, they got paid twice because after bargaining for a higher wage in exchange for no dress time, now they're going back and getting paid for the dress time. So they got paid for twice.
Plaintiffs did not end up with a higher the bargaining history, which is irrelevant to this dispute, plaintiffs contend, was that Kraft declared impasse in 1984, reduced wages by over $2 an hour, and only after exerting its dominance in that way were plaintiffs able to gave up the 12 minutes of donning and doffing time in order to get an increase from that lower amount that was less than what they had before when they were also getting paid for the 12 minutes of donning and doffing time. But that's part of the collective bargaining process. That negotiation is something that the labor relations laws allow for the parties to pursue. They would not allow the parties to negotiate a minimum wage lower than Wisconsin's minimum wage, regardless of whether the union for some reason would agree to that. That simply is not permissible. Similarly here, they're not allowed to bargain for a maximum hour provision that is higher than the Wisconsin the hours that are permissible under Wisconsin law before going into overtime.
Come back to my question. It would be perfectly lawful, as a matter of Wisconsin law, for the collective bargaining agreement to provide a lower hourly wage, right? The hourly wage in this agreement is higher than the Wisconsin minimum wage, right?
Correct.
So if the employer and the union say, okay, Wisconsin is going to force us to include 12 minutes a day or 16 minutes a day more in the rate base, we can make the wage come out absolutely identically by reducing the rate per hour, and the total wage will therefore come out as we've specified it. Right?
That's correct.
That would be lawful as a matter of Wisconsin law, wouldn't it?
That would be lawful, correct.
All right. Doesn't it follow from that your understanding of Wisconsin law would interfere with collective bargaining by forcing the employer and the union to use that method of specifying, you know, we include 8 hours and 12 minutes per day, but at a 5% lower rate, rather than the way in which they have actually specified it? I mean, that's the argument, best argument, I think, for Kraft. And why isn't that a good enough argument?
I may have misunderstood your question previously. Were you stating that they would bargain over a separate rate of pay for the donning and doffing time?
They bargain over the wage. Right. They say in the next round of bargaining, or the last one, had they anticipated this lawsuit, it would have said, okay, Wisconsin law is going to force us to compensate these workers for 15 minutes a day more than the actual amount of time they spend on the floor working. We want to pay them X dollars per week. And there are two variables that go into that: the number of hours they work and the wage per hour. state law is going to force us to put 15 minutes into the hours per work. We will therefore reduce the hourly rate so that the wage per week comes out X, exactly where the collective bargaining agreement now puts it. And that would comply with Wisconsin law, right?
That would comply with Wisconsin law.
So the whole dispute here, had your position been anticipated, is one that the collective bargaining agreement could have handled. And therefore, it looks like your position is one that requires, that interferes with the process of collective bargaining agreement. It specifies what needs to be in the agreement in order to achieve the result the union and the employer want.
The hypothetical you're setting forth is something that could only be done after future negotiations.
But that's the concern, that your reading and the district court's reading of state law is one that will affect the negotiations between the union and the employer and the contents of the collective bargaining agreement.
It would affect those agreements the same way that the minimum state minimum wage affects those agreements if Wisconsin would have...
No, minimum wage can't be avoided. There's nothing you can put in a federal collective bargaining agreement that can specify a lower minimum wage than state law. This effect occurs only if the employee's wage exceeds the state law minimum wage, and we're talking about the number of hours in the rate base.
Correct. And in the current situation, plaintiffs are working more than the maximum hours set forth by Wisconsin law without being paid for that extra time, because the Wisconsin law sets a lower maximum hour limit.
But we're still going backwards here. We're negotiating for time already worked, right? This is what this is all about, time already worked.
It's negotiating for time already worked, but there is a provision in the settlement agreement that Kraft will change its policies to comply with the decision
going
in this
forward,
case.
Sure, I can understand that, but I mean we're also the money. I assume the settlement agreement is for what's already been done. Work already.
That is correct.
Changing that's already been completed.
Right, that's correct. And I guess the simple response to Judge Easterbrook's hypothetical is that there are simply some things that parties cannot collectively bargain over. And the Supreme Court has made it clear that hourly employees are not required to bargain for things that they'd otherwise be entitled to as a matter of course, which is the situation here. If the Court has no other questions, I will conclude. Thank you.
Counsel, anything further, Mr. Conley?
Ms. Curran made the statement that the collective bargaining process is irrelevant, and that's exactly the problem with the plaintiff's position here. It's not irrelevant. The collective bargaining agreement that the parties undertook, which is well above minimum wage, above general restrictions on hours worked, negotiated a very narrow point. The parties negotiated it. Over the course of 25 years, the parties relied upon the distinction in compensation for this time. As the Court has noted, they were compensated otherwise for that. And it is exactly the collective bargaining agreement, the provision contemplated in 2030, as well as in the collective bargaining agreement itself on exclusion of time at the beginning and end of a shift, that they're seeking to override, and therefore seeking to override, contrary to preemption under Section 301, the exact terms of the collective bargaining agreement that one has to look at. To Judge Mannion's point, even when you're trying to calculate what the rights are here, it isn't a simple matter of 6 minutes at the beginning and end of a shift, because the collective bargaining agreement is more generous with respect to certain break times during the day. It's true that the parties to streamline this litigation agreed on a stipulated set of damages, but it's a complicated calculation as to whether they would be overcompensated under Wisconsin law, even if you assume they got the higher collective bargaining minimum rate than what was required under state law. There's still a question as to whether all that time would have been compensated in areas that were not required to be compensated, for example, longer break time or lunchtime. So this entire claim is tied up into the collective bargaining process, and for that reason, we submit is preempted. And for that reason, we'd ask this court to reverse the lower court's decision.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Connolly. The case will be taken under advisement.